Thanks for coming to the Seattle Arab and Iranian Film Festival. Tonight, we have a lecture by one of my favorite people. He's somebody that embodies the whole weblog revolution. To me, the weblog revolution means like I connect to the Angry Arab news service every day and find out about so many things that I would not have been aware of anywhere else. And his way of thinking, his critique is right on, and he's so independent and so well-grounded. He's somebody who actually reads and writes Arabic for a change. That's a radical concept for a pundit, you know, somebody who's commenting that he actually can understand the culture and read about it. So many of the people who basically are talking on behalf of the Arab world these days basically have a very limited notion. I've read some books, basically, you know, or they cover Saddam's trial one day and the next day they're covering the Michael Jackson trial, you know. So it's really nice to hear somebody from an Arab point of view and who's basically very well grounded and has encyclopedic knowledge of the area. So Professor Asad Abu Khalil is a native of Lebanon. He received his BA, MA from American University of Beirut, the same university I went to. That university is one of the amazing contributions that the U.S. actually made in the Middle East. The open universities, it was during that time when they used to kind of care about education. He has his PhD from Georgetown and teaches at Cal State University at Stanislaw and at the Center of Middle East Studies at UC Berkeley. He's the author of Bin Laden Islam, America's New War in Terrorism, and The Battle for Saudi Arabia. This lecture is sponsored by ADCCL, our very active local chapter of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We thank them so much for their support. And do check their website. They have a whole bunch of events coming up and interesting things. Thanks so much for your support and for being here. And I present you the Angry Arab.
Thanks. I'll speak, I believe, for 45 minutes, and then I'll be alerted if I go more on time. So please feel free to enter, or if you can signal me in the last 5 minutes, so I will wrap up. First of all, I should warn you that I certainly do not think that I am as well-grounded as John claims I am. I am here to speak about the political subjects of Arabs and Arab issues in American or non-American Western movies in general. But I will not speak in generalities except when asked about it later in the questions and answers sessions. I will speak very specifically about three movies that I have seen. In fact, when I first came here last night, they were two, and that was Kingdom of Heaven and Munich. And Ghida was rather horrified that I did not see Paradise Now, so I was incarcerated and made to watch just before this event, Paradise Now, so that I can comment about it. And then I scared her. I told her I dozed off and I didn't see it, but I did see it. I did see the whole thing, and I waited for the credits to come in. So I will speak about all of them, all three of them, but I'll begin about Paradise Now. But before I do that, I want to say some few general remarks about the topic at hand. It's very important that we have to keep track with whatever is being packaged, produced, commodified about the presentation and misrepresentation of Arabs and Muslims in American popular culture, in the culture industry. That is very important because it seems to me there is a reason why people have the views that they hold about Arabs and Muslims. I mean, there must be a reason why 93% of the American public supported a war in Afghanistan, a war that up until March 2003 used 22,400 bombs and missiles, 25% of which missed their targets, according to the figures of Central Command. I mean, there is a reason why 93% of you supported that war. There is a reason why, after September 11, Americans, by half of Americans, believe that people like me or John, American citizens of Arab descent, should be carrying special identification cards. That comes from somewhere. There is a reason why, recently, in a Washington Post public opinion survey that was conducted nationwide, it was revealed that unfavorable attitudes to Muslims have been increasing. And it seems to me it is way too easy for people on the liberal camp, on the left in general, to blame that on the administration. I don't think it's only the administration. I think there is something about the general culture. I'm speaking about political culture, popular culture. And when we speak about that, we are speaking about influences that go well beyond the confines of a Republican administration, well beyond NBC and CBS News. We're talking about novels that are being produced, books, scholarships, courses that are being taught, newspapers, music in some cases, visual arts, public debate, the general area of public sphere. That's where it's come from. I mean, as Barrington Moore said in his book about the social origins of dictatorship and autocracy, I mean, people do not get to have the culture that they have without having to be taken to universities, to be subjected to courses, being made to read newspapers, in extreme cases being punched and kicked. So the mechanism by which people acquire the values, attitudes that they hold comes from somewhere. This is not something that people just grab to from the air. Another point, by way of introduction, I want to say is that it's very important, those of us who belong to minority communities in the West, Arabs, Muslims in America, Arabs in America, or Arab Americans, Muslim Americans, call it what you want. It's very important that, especially at a time of crisis, we resist the crystallization of groupthink. Resist the crystallization of a groupthink. Because we are under attack, because there is acceptability of vilification, defamation, and just general stigmatization of the community at large, that we have to resist a groupthink developing, especially when leaders of Arab American organizations, Muslim American organizations are not independent. They are largely beholden to the oil money of Arab ruling dynasties. So their agenda, we have to stress, is independent from the agenda that we as progressives have to chart and stress. We have to own that agenda, because we cannot allow Arab American organizations and the media that they control to become similar to Arab media in the Middle East, which is controlled by Saudi oil wealth. Partly, another part of that important warning is that if we have groupthink, then we can lose our critical faculties. We can compromise our standards. I say that because I see that there is a tendency that we tend to celebrate whoever makes it, no matter how he or she made it, no matter what he or she has made by way of contributions to their culture, to the community, and to the general cause of sensitivity to the plight of people who are oppressed here and elsewhere. I mean, I don't think we should be, I have been attacked by people because I am not a fan of Mustafa Al-Aqad, who tragically died last year. I don't think that we have, because we think he is big, in the Arab world they think he's much bigger than he actually is. I realized that when I was in Los Angeles one time during the O.J. Simpson trial, and he was interviewed as O.J.'s neighbor. And in the Los Angeles Times they said, and his neighbor, Mustafa Al-Aqad, who says that he is producer in Hollywood, And I remember I told people in the Middle East that story. It hurt many of them. But I told them, we have to be honest. We have to be truthful. We cannot do what some elements of Lebanese culture, like in LBC TV, some of you know it, do, whereby they celebrate somebody who may or may not be of Lebanese, that's what they emphasize, extraction, even if they happen to be enemies of all the causes that are dear and important to Arabs in America. I think we should not shy away from saying Mustafa Al-Aqad produced lousy movies. We have to care about the gender question in the various Halloween movies that he was helped finance and produce. And also, I mean, his movie The Message, for which he is widely famous in the Muslim world. I know it's being sold outside, but I have to say that, you know, I think it's a lousy movie. Why should we not say that? So it seems to me we have to assert our independence as intellectual artists and so on. So I say that particularly when I get to the subject of paradise now. And sometimes there's another element, which is if our portrayal has been so bad for so long, is there a danger that we can settle not for, I don't want to use the word objective because I hate it and I don't believe in it, but for a decent portrayal, but sometimes we may settle for less bad portrayal. And sometimes I worry that's exactly what happens. And I think that's exactly what happens in the three movies I will talk to you about tonight. I mean, in other words, if we have been portrayed as quarter of humans, should we celebrate when we get portrayed as half human? Or should we aspire to be portrayed as full human? I think the latter. I think we should not compromise our standards because somebody thought that Munich was not as bad as Exodus. And I beg to disagree, because I think there's more dangers in a movie like Munich because it can penetrate walls of ideological lines much better than Exodus. Propaganda is much more successful when it doesn't parade as propaganda. And that's the danger. There's another element too in a movie like Munich, which is, you know, on O'Reilly's show on Fox News, he ends every show by quoting some email from somebody who says that, you know, you are a very extreme liberal. I mean, that person must be like so out of his mind or her mind to say that. And then he quotes somebody every night. You can watch that. And he quotes somebody who says, oh, you're too extreme right-winger. He has to do that. I mean, of course, we all know where he stands. I mean, he's an extreme right-wing, hateful human being. But he has to do that at the end of the show so that he'll say, well, I'm attacked from the left and the right, so I am right at the center. That's exactly what Steven Spielberg did with Munich. You know, people said, well, you know, it was attacked by the Israelis and attacked by lunatic Arabs like myself. And I say, no, it wasn't attacked by Israelis. I mean, some reviews in Israel said that it was boring, but the substance wasn't. The substance was not. There was one Israeli diplomat who said the movie wasn't good portrayal for Israel, and that was, I believe, not conspiratorially, but so noticeably widely publicized, because they needed that. They needed that to do the O'Reilly trick. I mean, this very gimmicky trick to say, well, if it wasn't liked by this Israeli and by lunatic, I mean, lunatics on both sides don't like it, so it must be doing something well. And it is with pain that I watched Arab American, Muslim American organizations heap praise on all three movies that I will discuss with you this evening. Let me begin by Paradise Now. I mean, of course, I was not going to talk about a movie that I have not seen, so I was subjected to seeing it. I did not know what to expect. To be honest with you, I had negative preconceived notion. I watched him interviewed on one show on Al Jazeera, and I just didn't like the message. But I really wanted to keep an open mind to see what he has to say. And I must confess to you that Western acclaim, unlike the way it works in some Lebanese media like LBC TV, for me it's not a source of credibility, but it's a source of suspicion. I think for a movie like Paradise Now to penetrate the walls of mainstream acceptability, you know, Golden Globe and mainstream reviewers, newspapers all around America and Europe, as well as the Academy Awards, even though it did not win, I mean, there must be a reason. I mean, Arabs have been producing movies for a very long time, and I can certainly think of some movies that have been produced in the Arab world that I like much better, and I think they deserved much more acclaim than they have achieved. You know, I was just talking about this Egyptian movie, which I like, and I show it when I teach my class on gender and sexuality in the Middle East, called Ahlam Hind wa Camelia. I mean, I think it's a wonderful movie, but, you know, it's not famous. I mean, the reason is, I think that you have to ask yourself the extent to which a movie that is liked in the West reinforces already existing views. And to what extent a movie that succeeds in the West challenges already existing values and attitudes, and to what extent it reinforces what they already believe. And I think this is an important question, particularly with Paradise Now. I mean, I think it was a good movie to see it. I mean, I will not comment on techniques and cinematography. That's not my specialty. There are people, specialists, John and others, can comment on that. I will speak about something I know, which is the political content and the message, and how it plays, and what kind of service it renders, or what kind of disservice it renders. I think he's a good storyteller. The story was told well. It grabbed your attention. It did. But, you know, I waited until the very end. I wanted to be faithful to my host and watch it and read every single line of the credits. And I couldn't help notice at the end, among the people that were thanked, I saw the name of Sally Field. Sally Field, I thought. I mean, when I teach a course on gender and sexuality in the Middle East, I always mention Sally Field. I do. I really do. Because I always begin my class by asking my students, how many of them have seen that really lousy movie called Not Without My Daughter? And it is always painful to me to watch how many of my students who have not read books usually on the Middle East, have not seen the good movies that you and I would like, have seen Not Without My Daughter. And if there's a movie that has more condescension, more racism, more sexism of Middle Eastern women, it is absolutely that movie. I mean, it's basically, you know, it's a more vulgar female Lawrence of Arabia in Persia, of course. I mean, and it also has that very important racist element you see in many Western movies. Notice when the characters speak in Persian, first of all, they're not translated. And notice that they're always angry. Arabs, Muslims in general, always have to come across in news media. Notice how much we see them, you know, chanting death to America and so on. You get the impression they do that all day long. And of course, at night, they are praying all night long. I mean, that's their lives. There's nothing else. I mean, they sometimes take breaks to toss grenades in crowded streets and so on. So you see that in Not Without My Daughter. And of course, when I saw that, I had to wonder. I mean, why would Sally Field, but I've seen the movie by that time. So, I mean, I can see why Sally Field would not object to the movie. To what extent her sensibilities coincided with the sensibilities of that movie. More on that in a second. There are certain things I liked about that movie. I liked the Palestinian dialect that was spoken. And the translation, not entirely accurate, I must confess. I wish it was more faithful. The colorful language and all should have been translated. But it was good. They spoke in their own language in that wonderful, distinctive Palestinian accent. Palestinian accent, those of us who are Arabs, is a very distinctive accent. You see, if I ask Arabs here to tell a Tunisian accent from a Moroccan accent, they will have a hard time. But if you ask them to tell a Palestinian accent from a Syrian or a Lebanese accent, they will be able to tell it. And you don't see that much. You don't see it in Western popular culture. You don't see it in Arab popular culture. In Lebanon today, where Palestinians are being quite oppressed, you don't hear Palestinian accent as much. So that pleased me. That pleased me, part of the aesthetics of it. Another thing that occurred to me, and that's where the movie did not succeed, Palestinians have lives. And I think people in the West, and we in the Arab world, have been guilty in not acknowledging that Palestinians live their lives. And they are entitled to live their lives. They are entitled not to be consumed by struggle 24 hours a day. Palestinians eat, drink, dance, sing, make love, fall in love, fall out of love, create art, create poetry. It is true, of course, because of the tragedy, Palestinian popular and political cultures have more than a tinge of melancholy. Of course, it's shaped by the kind of humiliation, occupation, and killing that have been visited upon them since the advent of Zionism into their indigenous land. But it seems to me, because I read on the plane a novel by a new friend of mine, a Palestinian, her name is Soher Dawood, and her novel, which I recommend to those who read Arabic, it's not translated, called Medina al-Rasas, City of Bullet. It's about her life. And it's not about politics. And I thought we should allow them to live their life. In that movie, not as much. And I think when we allow Palestinians to live their lives, we begin to humanize them, because Palestinians have suffered from dehumanization, consistent dehumanization, especially in Western popular and political cultures. You know, even the scene in the movie, two kids were flying a kite. The kite was a Palestinian flag. I mean, in a way, I understand that. Yes, of course, Palestinian popular culture is very political. The Palestinian people are very political. They are consumed by news. I mean, they have to. I mean, they are being shot as pigeons regularly. And the occupation is a real thing over their lives, over their chest. Every family is shaped by it. Whether they live inside the occupied territories, whether they were occupied in 48 or 67, so that we don't remember occupation when it started, or they live in refugee camps, squalid refugee camps, in the Arab world. And it seems to me that we did not see. I say that because we have an extra effort to, I don't say humanize the Palestinian, to show them as they are. To show them as they are. Not every Palestinian is a member of an organization. Some are, some are not. Some of them are active members of artist syndicates, writer syndicates. They are poets, you know? And that didn't come across. And this is something, to what extent this movie reinforced the view that Israeli humans are more human than Palestinian humans. To what extent are Israeli civilians more civilian than Palestinian civilians? Because this is something that I complain about throughout in Western popular culture and in some Arab culture. You see, we live in the age of globalization. When I watch some Saudi Arab media today, it is their standards, or lack thereof, or their sensibilities, or lack thereof, or their parameters, or their criteria of coverage, they are indistinguishable from those of Fox News. It's a matter of degree. It's a matter of degree. In the movie, for example, I mean, we saw the Israelis on the beach as a crowd. And the very last scene, we saw Israeli soldiers armed in the bus, and they were smiling. There was a man and a woman talking together. I mean, that's a message to the audience. Even their armed soldiers are more human than unarmed Palestinians. I mean, this is something I personally am attuned to because I lived through the age of dehumanization of Palestinian civilians. I mean, this is what Munich is about. I mean, Munich is about humanization of Israeli killers and dehumanization of Palestinian civilians. That's what the movie is about. That's how the killing of large number of people becomes acceptable. That's how you numb the senses. Western senses have been numbed for a very long time. I mean, what else can explain the fact that not a single act of killing of any Palestinian civilians gets to be labeled as terrorist? You see, I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, there's a reason for that. I mean, if it's a matter of degree, we can argue. I mean, if some acts of murder by Israel are called terrorism, and some acts of murder by Palestinians are called terrorism, then I think there is a room here we can engage in dialogue. But it seems to me, how can you, I mean, the gulf is so wide between us that not a single act of killing by Israel is ever called terrorist. It just doesn't. Because they are killing the right people. No matter whether civilians or armed, the people they are killing are not as expensive as human beings as those who are being killed in much lower numbers by Palestinians. So in that sense, we had to see the soldiers and we had to humanize them to the audience. And that in itself could easily get the seal of approval of Sally Field, Golden Globe, and other Western reviewers of the movie. You know, this question about the distinction between Palestinians as humans and Israelis. There's a book by an Israeli reporter, my enemy, my friend. It's about an Israeli, you know, this is something that Grace Halsell did in the 1960s, who changed her pigmentation, and she posed as an African-American in the South. She used to work for Lyndon Johnson, and she wrote a book about her experiences living as a white person, but disguised as an African-American in the Deep South in the 1960s. An Israeli reporter tried to do the same. So he posed as an Arab. He's an Israeli Jewish person, posed as an Arab, and he lived in Israel for a few months. And he wrote this expose about his experiences. And there is a scene in that book which remains with me, and it remained with him. He said one time he was working as a dishwasher at an Israeli restaurant. And he said he was in the kitchen when two Israeli Jewish workers started having sex naked in the kitchen with him, standing there. I mean, he's invisible. I mean, this is like why slaves in the past used to be allowed in the harem areas in the royal courts of the Ottoman Empire. Because they were not seen as threatening. They are not fully human beings. They are slaves. And it seems to me, this is why one has to... It seems to me it's not much to ask that the humanity, the full humanity of the Palestinian people be captured on film. Now we get to the subject of suicide bombing. Without getting into that, there's a fundamental flaw about that in the movie, which is how do Palestinians get to be suicide bombers? And this is a fundamental flaw of the movie. In the movie, basically, you had a fanatical Muslim looking very suspicious and very unsavory character, kind of cynical in appearance and his smile. And he's the one who said, you know, we're recruiting you for that mission. That's not how it works. That's not how it works. I mean, I've studied Palestinian and Lebanese organizations over the years, and it's vice versa. It's not that these manipulative, cynical leaders get to recruit individual Palestinians to engage in attacks. It is individual Palestinians who plead and beg and knock on doors of Palestinian officials to insist on being sent on attacks. That is totally missing from the portrayal of this. I'll tell you a story. I don't mind. It's a personal one. When I was 10 years old, my cousin, a Lebanese Muslim who was an atheist at the time, she lives in Beirut, so nobody can like try to arrest her now. She was in her 20s, a Lebanese woman. She was a member of a Marxist Palestinian organization, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. She went, and for more than a year, she told me the story later. She pleaded with Palestinians to send her on hijacking mission. The aim was to free, not to slam planes into buildings like you know the Bin Laden fanatical kooks terrorists do. She wanted the time, and of course, many of them are now critical of what happened and so on. But she wanted to engage in attack in order to pressure Israel to release Palestinian prisoners who are in the thousands. They are always in the thousands. And after pleading with many of them, and they didn't want to send her, they agreed. So they sent her on one, and the first time they were arrested, and then they were released. And then she went back. And she insisted and pleaded. And then she went again and she did hijack a plane. That's how it happens. Laila Khalid, the famous Palestinian hijacker, the first, not the first female hijacker ever, but you know the famous one who wrote her biography in English, My People Shall Survive. It was in Arabic and translated to English. I mean, the same thing. She went the first time, then she went the second time. She pleaded with them. She wanted to do it. There was a case recently in Palestine. Her last name is Al-Akhras. You may have heard of her. She went and knocked on the doors of several groups. She wanted to be sent. It's not that there are some people who are manipulating them. You know, this is what Israel and the United States wanted you to believe, of course. They want you to believe that there are these cynical, bad Palestinians who are taking these people against their will. Or there's another worse scenario, which is they do it for the money that their families get later. I mean, really. I mean, does anybody believe that's what people are willing to give up in get to again $10,000 that Saddam used to cynically manipulate send to their families? That's not why it happens. That's what, I mean, killing is in their daily lives. I mean, as Egyptian poets said, you know, blood is under the pillow, blood is on our nightgowns, blood is everywhere. I mean, if you are in Palestinians, on the other end of unending Israeli onslaught against Palestinians, which started long before the state of Israel was established and long before the Munich attack. So this operational mechanism is very flawed in the movie, and it reinforces a Western myth. You see, and there's also this personal account about that his father was a collaborator who was killing. He wanted to prove that he is a good Palestinian in order to erase the shame of what his father did. I mean, Israeli propaganda has always been desperate. Every time a Lebanese or Palestinian engages in an attack, they go and search into his background or her background. I mean, sometimes they get the most outrageous personal elements of their story. Sometimes they said, oh, this woman, when she was 15, she kissed her neighbor, and that's why she was afraid that they're going to be killed, and that's why she wanted to do and die. Like they are doing it for suicide, non-political. Oh, no. In their minds, without what you or I think about that, they are doing it for political purposes. I mean, they want to inflict harm on the enemy with little regard for their civilians, just as Israel kills in far larger scale Palestinians with no regard whatsoever. I have been on their receiving end, distinctions between civilians or armed people. I mean, it's not something novel. And let us also remember this issue, which is mentioned several times in the movie, about killing collaborators, which seems to bother our director here. I mean, in every movement, there was killing of collaborators. A gruesome killing of collaborators. It happens in the French struggle against the Nazis. The resistance movement in France killed, you know, a large number of collaborators, much more than Palestinians killed. The Algerian struggle for independence, the struggle against apartheid, they used to necklace them, if you remember, not a lovely way to die. And yet, it doesn't get condemnation. But that also proves something about the Palestinian struggle. The standards that are applied to the Palestinians are applied to no other struggle in the world. There is no struggle where there is more scrutiny for everything they do or say than we are talking about their poetry is scrutinized. One time there was an uproar in the Western world because Mahmoud Darwish, the foremost Palestinian poet, said some line that bothered Amos Oz, and then as a result, the entire Western world was in uproar. I mean, there's something wrong with there. I mean, when the victims are scrutinized and the victimizers absolutely have no standard on them, not on what they say and not in how many and how they kill the other sides. And yet, of course, we have the character, I forgot what's her name in the movie, the famous French actress, Lubna Zabel, in the movie. And, I mean, she appears in many French movies, as you know. She's Belgian, I think, not French. I'm not sure. Her character, I mean, first of all, it seems like she's coming from the West. You know, as a result, she has, one surmises, Western wisdom. She's the one who was like giving these pearls of wisdoms to the Palestinian people. And of course, she works at a human rights organization. So, I mean, that's an additional dosage of wisdom to the Palestinian people. And she gave them a few pearls of wisdom. Among them, that what's this going to do? Aren't there any forms of struggle? Palestinians have never thought about that until a character from France came to them, or a scriptwriter from the Netherlands who wrote this movie brought it up to them. Wow, what a revelation. Well, the answer is the Palestinians have thought all of this all along. No, it's more than that. The Palestinians have practiced this all along. It is not, I mean, I wish one of the characters would yell to her. I wish I was in the movie to yell to her. Palestinians are doing that as we speak. Palestinians have never exclusively engaged in violent struggle for their independence. As we speak, they are engaged in literary struggle, non-violent struggle, in boycotts, in poetry, in arts, in every form of struggle imaginable. They have thought about it. In graffiti, did you see the walls? That struggle. Not a single wall in the movie was blank. Palestinians are resisting in words. But yet, you know, I don't know. The movie, the director, and our French visitor did not notice that, because Palestinians who struggle only struggle. I mean, that's an association, by the way. That's the danger of it. You associate Palestinian struggle with only violence. So as a result, you discredit all Palestinian struggle. But there's something more important than that. Palestinians, for much of the early history of the Arab-Israeli question, did not pursue violent struggle. I am not going to quote to you here some left-wing sources. I will quote the most right-wing, and I would dare say racist, Israeli historian Benny Morris, who now accepts ethnic cleansing. In his book, Righteous Victims, he says, between 1948 and early 1960s, you know, most Palestinians used to try to go from where I come from. I come from South Lebanon. Palestinians used to try to sneak into their homeland, to check on their house, to check in their orchards, to see if something they buried outside of their house still there. And they used to be shot as pigeons. Now, do you know how many Palestinians, unarmed, who tried to visit their properties were killed by Israelis from 1948 until 1960s by the count of Benny Morris? Thousands. Thousands. So you're telling me that Palestinians, when they practice nonviolent struggle, as they did from 48 to 1960s, there was so much sympathy for them? No. Not only there was no sympathy, they didn't exist. They did not exist. And the answer is, let's face it, when the Palestinians began, and that's not unique to the Palestinians, when they engage in violence, the word took notice. That's a fact. When you interview, as I have interviewed Palestinians who've engaged in attacks, who've hijacked planes, that's what they will tell you. Not to justify it, and you argue with them, but they will say, we lived at a time when Golda Meir said in 1969 the Palestinian people did not exist, and nobody said anything. She got away with it. I mean, it was an Israeli, not a Palestinian, a prime minister of Israel from 1977 until 1983, Menachem Begin, who said in his memoir, The Revolt, I fight, therefore I am. It became an existential assertion. Why is that possible for the Israeli Zionist fighters but not for the Palestinians? Because the standards applied to Palestinian struggles are so unique, are so peculiar. There is no struggle that have to adhere to the most unusual standards like Palestinian struggle. And let's remember the case of a Palestinian American, a Quaker, Mubarak Awad. Mubarak Awad went to Palestine and he started a center for nonviolence. What did Israel do? Kick him out. They kicked him out, never to be allowed back to Palestine. And you're going to tell me the Western world was so outraged and took up his case and fought for the right of Mubarak Awad to engage in nonviolent struggle? No, nobody noticed, nobody cared. And he is an American citizen for whatever that's worth. And then our visiting French person told our Palestinian interlocutors, you know, what's about revenge? What's the validity of revenge? I mean, who doesn't engage in revenge? I mean, let's face it. The war in Afghanistan was a war of revenge. That's why 93% of Americans supported it. I mean, the Taliban were not the one who attacked attacked America. Al-Qaeda attacked America, you know. But this was an identifiable target. You see, the debate about Iraq is a debate about revenge. I mean, some Americans believe that Afghanistan was legitimate revenge, and other Americans believe, yes, but we need more revenge. Let's go to Iraq. And Americans, but in fairness, some Americans were against Iraq. They said, no. Afghanistan was a good revenge. Let's stop at that. I mean, Israel uses the language of revenge. I mean, they said retaliation, revenge. That's what it is, right? I mean, the book on which the movie Munich was based, it's called Vengeance. I mean, Israel uses that rather unabashedly. You see, but no. Just as Arab violence, Muslim violence is peculiar, a violence that is worse than any other violence, and it gets a cultural and religious label, same thing for revenge. Western revenge is superior, is enlightened, is civilized. But you see, Middle East revenge, Arab revenge, Muslim revenge, evokes images of bloodthirsty, inferior, backward Arabs and Muslims. And that's why it's more objectionable, and that's why I guess our French visitor was that offended by that. Okay. On Kingdom of Heaven, I want to say that a basic message of the movie, which of course is very bothersome to me, is that it's not that crusades are bad in themselves, but that they are, I mean, by the way, if you want to read longer versions of my reviews of Kingdom of Heaven and Munich, they are available on my website, and I will be writing, I guess, another angry review of Paradise Now upon arriving to California tomorrow, if not tonight, that's how angry I am. Kingdom of Heaven, basically, it's, I mean, what bothers me about it the most is that it didn't say crusades are bad in themselves. No, it didn't say that. It said there are good crusades and there are bad crusades. There are good crusaders and there are bad crusaders. Let's face it, the heroes of the movie are the good crusaders. And the bad ones are the bad crusaders and the multitude of the Arabs. I mean, that's the whole cult of Saladin. I mean, the cult of Saladin in the West, despite the portrayal of him as being magnanimous and so wonderful and civilized and calm and rational, is that it's not that he is a good Arab. No. He is the exceptional Arab. He is the exceptional Muslim. I mean, he is like, because he is not like them. You know, it's like when I went to the American University of Beirut, and my name, many of my Christian classmates used to think that my family name is Christians. And then when they would learn that it's not, I often heard, and they took it as a compliment because, it's an insult, they would say, but you're not like other Muslims. And what they meant by that is, you seem to clash with the horrible stereotypes we have in our heads of what Muslims should be like. And that's what they meant. And that's why Saladin appealed to the West and appealed to Ridley Scott, because he did not seem as, you know, savage, as horrible as the stereotypes that they hold in their heads of Arabs. So basically, and there were messages that applies to the current war. I mean, there is clear extrapolation of that movie at the time it was released, and Ridley Scott made no bones about that, to the international events of 2000, at the time of release, 2004. Basically, Rumsfeld is bad, but Bush is good. That in the current wars in the Middle East, there are good fighters, good crusaders, bad crusaders. I also noticed at the end of the movie that the king of Morocco was thanked. This is in Kingdom of Heaven, by the way. Yeah, that didn't surprise me. Just as it didn't surprise me that Arab American and Muslim American organization praised the movie. You know? I mean, because they thought that, you know, again, half human or quarter humans, how are we portrayed? When we get half human, we're celebrating. That's what happened. If anything, it seems to me, I always look for the litmus test. For me, Arabs are always portrayed like that famous painting by Renoir called The Mosque. Renoir's painting, The Mosque, the Arabs appear as an indistinguishable blob. They don't have features. They don't have characteristics. They just appear as this very unidentifiable blob. And I always use that litmus test of Renoir's painting, because I see it all the time. I see it in news media, I see it in popular culture, movies, and so on. By the way, it's a very uncomfortable chair. I have to throw that in. And in the Kingdom of Heaven, Western injured and dead are personalized. Not the dead and injured of the Arabs. That's, by the way, true always of Palestinians and news media. The dead and injured of Palestinians are not portrayed. Dead and injured of Israelis are always portrayed. I always look for one thing in the New York Times. Notice, I mean, look how much Israel kills of Palestinians. I mean, yesterday they killed. I mean, almost daily, but you don't hear about it. Palestinians get news attention when, like, I don't know, 50 of them get killed in one day, then it's news. Israelis, of course, even if it's an injury or stabbing of an Israeli, gets press attention. That's the different standards. Notice when there is something like that, a killing of an Israeli, the New York Times and other Western media will have coverage of the funeral. I always look for that. The message is Israelis mourn their dead. Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, they don't mourn their dead. They don't. You know, how often whenever Western governments go to war against developing countries, they always have that cliche, they don't value human life the way we do. That always appears. Arabs die, Arabs demonstrate, and Arabs fight, always as a collective mob. as a blob. That's how they are. There's also something very disturbing in that movie when there was a Westerner digging water in the desert for the Arabs, and they were so excited. If you read the history of science, you would find that the Crusades, when they went there, they were so behind. They were so behind. I mean, if you look at medicine, look at hygiene at the time, I mean, there was very little that the West could teach those Muslim heathen at the time of the Crusades. Trust me on that one. I have the evidence on my website in that long review, by the way. I mean, if you look at the Arabs, when they encountered them during the Crusades, they were horrified. I mean, they were horrified at their medicine. I mean, it wasn't medicine. It was like, you know, charlatans kind of stuff. There are like graphic details I give on that. Or if you look at their penal system, I mean, there was one Arab survivor of the Crusades who wrote his book, and it's translated into English. I have the full citation. And he says he witnessed one time they punished somebody. They threw that person in water, and if he was supposed to sink, then it means that he was innocent. And the guy tried to sink himself so bad, and he couldn't. So these are the standards. But of course, the Westerners always have to teach the Arabs about how to, people were digging canals in ancient times in the Middle East. But of course, you cannot believe that because the Israelis made the desert bloom. There was, of course, so many things missing from that movie, like the capture of Jerusalem. And of course, now we have the myth of Judeo-Christian solidarity and brotherhood and sisterhood. In reality, I mean, the Jews were victims of Christianity. But you cannot say that. People in Judaic studies in America are very offended at that term, Judeo-Christian. This is a political term. This is not a historical term. I mean, Jews have been victims of the anti-Semitism which was born within the womb of the church. I mean, you've read, the various books that came out, Gary Will's The Papal Sins or Constantine's Sword by Cahill and various other books on that, you know? I mean, when the Crusaders came to Jerusalem in 1099, I mean, the last remaining Jews, mostly old people, were held, unarmed, of course, in the last old remaining synagogue, and they were all butchered by the Crusades. According to a Muslim chronicler, Ibn al-Athir history, 70,000 people were slaughtered in the Aqsa Mosque alone. A Western account put the figure at 65,000. Also, let us remember how the Crusades, when they were traveling, you know, we saw this noble man, he was the heroic figure coming to the Holy Land. In reality, the travel from Europe into the Holy Land was a festival of pillage, plunder, and mayhem. I mean, they killed every Jewish person they encountered. And they killed, Orthodox Christians who came in their way. There were Christians who fought on the side of the Arabs, as you probably know. And in fact, in the movie, it doesn't say when Saladin took over Jerusalem, it's not true that the Christians had to leave, no. Many Christians petitioned Saladin, and they were permitted to stay, and they were made to pay a tax, and they were allowed to stay in peace. That wasn't in the movie. Now, on Munich. Unfortunately, that's what I have so much to say, because that movie made me more angry than all the previous two, as I mentioned. As I told you, that the title of that movie for me, the subtitle is Humanization of Israeli Killers and Dehumanization of Palestinian Civilians. This is a true story about real victims and real killing and real blood. And the most basic flaw of the movie is that the book, you can read it, Jonas' book, Vengeance, I mean, Spielberg, for propaganda purposes, changed one major element of the story. In that book, it says, the killers had no regrets, had no qualms. They had no second thoughts. And in the movie, the characters were unendingly wrought up with guilt, with second thoughts, with anguish, with anxiety. I mean, we still have that in American propaganda about Israel. Notice how many articles they write about Israeli. I mean, the most sensitive articles I have read in the U.S. media since I came to this country 23 years ago is about the anguish of Israeli soldiers. I mean, nothing infuriates me more than these articles. And these are usually the liberal reporters. They write about the anguish of the soldiers of occupation. You see, so even they cannot see to identify with the victims who are occupied, so they see, they bond, they identify with the soldiers. So they made it, I mean, look at liberal voices in America about Israel, like Tikkun magazine. I mean, basically, it's a magazine devoted to celebration of the anguish, anxieties of Israeli occupation soldiers. And when Israel is asked to leave the West Bank or some part of it, I mean, part of 22% of historic Palestine, it's always because it's good for the soul of Israel. It's good for Israel. It's not because it's good for the Palestinians. In Munich, it is not true that Munich was, and I should add that there's a recent memoir of an Israeli head of Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, Halavi, and it was published in England, not yet in America, and in it he said the same thing. He said, I had no regrets, no second thoughts. So if the Israelis are saying, we had no regrets, second thoughts, Steven Spielberg insists, oh no, you did. Oh no, you did. Even when you were having sex with your wives, you were thinking about the killing. I mean, he had to. He had to make their killing more palatable to the audience, and it worked. In Munich, it's not true, the movie says, that the attack on the athletes in Munich was a watershed in Israel, and it changed the country from a peaceful, loving country into one that is seeking revenge. No, no, no. Munich was a watershed only in one regard. It was a watershed in Israeli propaganda. How Israel was able to use that in order to capture more of the Western public opinion, and they succeeded. Israeli killings of Palestinians, wholesale and assassinations, civilians and non-civilians, preceded long before Munich. In fact, you know how Munich started? I mean, it reminds me of Paradise Now, how the guy was recruited. In 1972, in February, Israel bombed the shit out of Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. Palestinians were outraged. Palestinians used to be studying in the United States and in Europe and used to go in the summer and get training. They wanted to join the resistance. One of them, the head of the team, by the way, who spoke German, that's his story. He was studying to be an engineer. And he was outraged about the killing of Israeli civilians before Munich. So they went to their leaders and said, we have to do something. We have to do something. They kept pressing, pressuring, pleading, beseeching with their leaders until they told them, okay, we'll do something. And Munich was improvised. It was improvised under pressure from their members, not vice versa. It's not that the followers or Arafat was recruiting them, manipulating them, sending them to their death. It's the other way around. It's the other way around. And long before Munich, Israel excelled in sending letter bombs, not to Palestinian leaders, to poets, artists. Ghassan Kanafani, the famous Palestinian writer, novelist, artist, was before Munich. It killed him, along with his 14-year-old niece, car bomb. Bassam Abu Sharif, a Palestinian writer, never held a gun like Ghassan Kanafani. He also was disfigured with a Palestinian Israeli letter bomb long before Munich. You know, I mean, these things are immediate to me. Ghassan Kanafani was a close friend of my uncle. Bassam Abu Sharif's, I shook the disfigured fingers of Bassam Abu Sharif. I have seen some of these surviving victims of Israeli terrorism before Munich. Another one is scholar, academic, Anis Sayeg, received another letter bomb. He had absolutely never carried a gun in his hand. Anis Sayeg also received a letter bomb from Israel because he started the first Palestinian think tank, not because he orchestrated Munich. Last time I was in Lebanon 2 years ago, I helped him, after I met with him and so on, I helped him walk to his apartment. He can't see from that letter bomb that was sent to him by Israel long before Munich. In the movie, by the way, another thing occurred which is just like not without my daughter. There were no subtitles for the Arabs in that movie, if you notice. It doesn't matter what the natives speak. It doesn't matter what they say in Persian or Arabic. We only need to know what the Westerners, people like us, like you, I guess, people like you have to say. Sally Field and so on. And of course, there were so many things about the Israeli, all-knowing Israeli intelligence. One major element about Israel in the movie and American popular culture that they are so skilled in their Israeli intelligence. In reality, and this is the part not told in that movie, Israeli intelligence has not been good. Has not been good, has not known about Palestinians as much as they claim. In fact, former CIA director Admiral Stansfield Turner once said about Israel that this is an Israeli intelligence agency which gets a C grade, but they get an A+ in PR. That's what Israeli intelligence is about. I mean, would you be shocked if I tell you the 11 names that were prepared on the list by Israeli intelligence after Munich, only one of them was really involved in Munich? The rest had absolutely nothing to do with them. I mean, I can go with names. It'll be too technical for you. The first one, a cousin of a friend of mine, he was a poet. He was an academic. The Palestinian representative in Rome, Wael Zuaiter, had nothing to do with it. He was killed. 14 times shot. Spielberg doesn't tell you that. I'll tell you that. The Palestinian representative in France was killed. And that one was killed because he was engaged in peaceful negotiations with Israeli leftist groups. Israel didn't want that. I mean, that's the thing you have to understand. Israel does not like militant Palestinians, nor does Israel like peaceful Palestinians. Both of them are struck by Israeli violence. What the movie didn't tell you is a very important element of the Munich count post-Munich revenge by Israel. In 1973, an Israeli hit team, just to show you about how clumsy and how ignorant that organization is, which gets so much acclaim in the West. In 1973, Israeli intelligence thought they had basically captured the top mastermind of Munich, Abu Hassan Salami. He appeared in that movie, Munich, by the way, and he was on their hit list until they killed him in 1979. In Munich, at the end of the movie, when they ran the credit, they said he was later assassinated. But they didn't tell you how he was assassinated. I'll tell you how he was assassinated. Israeli intelligence planted a car bomb on a street, crowded street where he was passing, killing tens of Lebanese and Palestinian civilians. My best friend was injured. That's how they killed him. But of course, Spielberg was not going to tell you that. I'll tell you that. In 1973, Israel was very excited. They thought they had that man. They staked him out. They were watching him. And then they killed him in Norway, while he was around the swimming pool of a hotel. His name is Ali Boucheki. I always want to mention his name. He is a Moroccan waiter. He is a Moroccan waiter. He resembled, according to Israeli intelligence, Abu Hassan Salami. And he was killed. Had nothing to do. Norwegian police arrested them. They cracked this supposedly superior team. And they put them in jail, but of course, Western support for Israel as it is, as it was, and they released them to save Israel the embarrassment. I should be wrapping up, John, right? I mean, there is so much more to tell you about what is accurate and what is not accurate, but I will conclude here with just one thought. To say, look, I understand after September 11, Arabs, Muslims are under attack. There is a mentality where people feel that the community is under siege. People feel that we have no friends, that there is very little sympathy for the plight of Arabs and Muslims, whether in America or in the Middle East. As a result, the danger is we lower our expectations and standards. As a result, we get very satisfied with crumbs of popular culture, with very little by way of decent, sensitive portrayal. And I think this explains the reason why people were not, among the Arabs, as critical of the three movies that I have mentioned. It pained me that I was probably the only Arabs in the Arab world or here who thought that Kingdom of Heaven was a lousy movie and that it shouldn't be applauded. But that's the point. I mean, if we have been humiliated and defamed and denigrated for all these years, it doesn't mean as a result we can be satisfied with some little token gestures that are fundamentally meaningless. This very much is like when George W. Bush, who's been fighting unending wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and which resulted in the death of innocent civilians in both countries, this is very much like when he, once a year, goes to the local mosque in Washington, D.C., as a gesture, I guess, of his cultural sensitivity. It seems to me, I am not extreme in thinking, that these gestures should only fool the foolish. Thank you for listening.
Shall I call on people? Yes, please. One more time. Please.
I was wondering what you thought of Fahrenheit 9/11 and its portrayal. I mean, the thing that bothered me about that movie was, here's Bush shaking one Arab's hand, here's Bush shaking another Arab's hand, and they used Saudi, they didn't say Arab, but it was clear what they meant, in my opinion.
Right.
And we're both equally critical of the Saudi royal family and their corruption and all that.
Right.
But the portrayal there really bothered me.
Right. I mean, again, if you're interested, on my website, there is a link to a long review I posted on that, so I will spare you a detailed critique of it, but I agree with the gist of what you asked, and I think the movie is guilty of negative, if not outrightly racist, references to Arabs. I mean, I think in the movie, any Saudi becomes guilty. I mean, what's wrong about Saudis being rushed out of the country when many of them faced attacks, and I know about that from my students. Many of them really faced serious retribution from angry Americans at the time, as well as from retribution from government and retribution from the people. And he made that to be some sinister plot. And another basic flaw of the movie is this, which is the same flaw in the book House of Bush and House of Saud, which is collaborative with that movie. Basically, when you talk about House of Bush, House of Saud, you made it sound as if the relationship between the Saudi government and the American government is one between two families. Oh, no. It is a much deeper relationship. This is a relationship that has tied the two governments together uninterruptedly from FDR all the way to this president, passing through your so-called human rights president, Jimmy Carter. And it seems to me when you focus on the Bush family, as if it's an entirely familial connection, as if Clinton was less beholden to the House of Saud and their interests than George W. Bush. So I totally reject that premise. So for that reason and many others, I am not a fan of this movie. But of course, I think Michael Moore has something that's very important. And since I came to this country, I've always talked about that, which is, I think we in the left in general, especially in the United States, and I would say in Lebanon, I've always made that point, we have a reputation which is well-deserved for being sanctimonious on the side of justice, but really lacking in irony and humor. I mean, I don't think there's any reason why we on the left should be as boring as we are perceived to be. And I think this is why, in general, leftist media have been very unsuccessful. And I think this is why Michael Moore has been a great success, because he's able to deliver a message, I mean, outside of that movie I'm talking about, a progressive message, and he does it humorously. And it seems to me the lesson for many of us. I mean, I don't see any reason why we in the left have to insist on presenting our message rather boringly and tediously, you know. Please. Right. In fact, no, I did not see Syriana, but I was afraid that I was going to be forced to watch Syriana also before the event. So it's not out of DVD. That's the only reason why I was not made to watch it. But no, you know what? I mean, again, I haven't seen it.
But I have heard people say that it's really better and so on. You know what? I really liked Three Kings, if you remember that. I really did. And I liked the footage of the trajectory of the bullet. I felt for the first time a movie was driving the point that bullets kill real people, it goes into the flesh. And I felt that was really important. So. Please. Najil Ali is a Palestinian cartoonist, celebrated, as you in America say, the little man or the little person. And he celebrated the little Palestinian refugee and the poor. I met Najil Ali. I can't say I knew him very well. I knew Najil Ali, and I liked Najil Ali very much. And I thought he was a very unique style. Najil Ali was an independent thinker. He did not submit to any government, to any authority, not even to that of Yasser Arafat. What I know is, and this is one of many reasons I do not celebrate the memory of Yasser Arafat, and I never respected Yasser Arafat, but that's one of many reasons. My understanding is Yasser Arafat ordered the murder of Najil Ali. And the people who were, one person was arrested with a revolver in London. He's somebody who worked for the Fatah organization. I'm not saying Fatah is responsible. No, Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is responsible because in one particular cartoon, that's what I gathered. Because I was very curious, because I was deeply upset about it, and I asked a lot of people who know, and in one cartoon, he mocked Yasser Arafat when he was in Tunisia, and he mocked about a particular personal relationship Yasser Arafat was having with a woman. And I think I should, like, my parents are lawyers, so I should remember, allegedly, that's why Yasser Arafat ordered the killing of Najil Ali. Please. Which one? Oh, yes. I mean, again, I hate to be self-referential, but if you're interested, I wrote a small piece on that on my website. I have not been a fan of that report. I wrote a note of dissent. She's talking about that famous report by the two professors at the University of Chicago and Harvard about the Israeli lobby. There are several things I didn't like about it. One of them is, I think, especially we Arabs in America, have to resist the temptation to believe that all U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is due to the machination of an evil Israeli lobby. In reality, American foreign policy is more complicated. And I also worry about any tendency to attribute all American foreign policy in the Middle East to a nefarious lobby. And I am not saying that everybody who talks about that is anti-Jewish, but some are. And I'm very sensitive against that. And I say this in Arabic all the time, the most supporters of Israeli lobby in America are non-Jews. They are Clinton, they are Reagan, they are Bush. These are the real support of Israel, not some handful of individuals or the neoconservative gang and so on. The Christian right is very influential in making of U.S. foreign policy. Why do we ignore that? You know, Congress, media, corporations. I mean, American foreign policy making is much more complex. For those reasons, I also tend to believe when you dwell on the lobby, you tend to basically assume that American policy in the world is so innocent and great and wonderful and benevolent. If it wasn't for the lobby, it would be peace all over the world. No. I mean, America's bad policies in the Middle East are parallel to America's bad policies in Latin America and in Asia. It is not an exception. But you know what does reinforce that message among Arabs? We have these retired U.S. diplomats who, 20 years after they leave office, and they feel guilty about what they didn't do when they were in office, and just before they die, or 2 years before, they come and tell Arab audiences, and they speak at Arab-American gathering, and they tell them, I couldn't do anything, it's all about the lobby. And there are some retired American congresspeople who cannot win the last election, and they come to American Arab-American audiences and they tell them, I lost because of the lobby. A former U.S. congressman, person from Illinois, Paul Findlay, wrote a book called They Dare to Speak Out, and it was widely read, translated, and it delivers that message. I don't like that message. It's not only the lobby. The lobby couldn't be powerful if the president, whoever he is or she is, makes it powerful. I mean, Bush is not running for re-election anymore. So it's not about Jewish money or about Jewish votes. I mean, he's independent now. And yet, his policies, why can't we accept that some people in America have policies and views that are synonymous with Likud or Labor in Israel? I mean, the Christian right thinks Sharon is moderate. You know, these are the Christian right. That's not the Israeli lobby. Plus, in that piece, on page one, they make an allegation that Arabs, and so I mean, without boring you with details, they make so many assumptions about Arabs and Middle Easterners that are so untrue. They say on page one that people in the Middle East are not happy with Bush because he promotes democracy. No. They are happy for the converse. People in the Middle East know what Mersheimer and Walt do not know, that Bush is not pushing for democracy in the Middle East. He's pushing for democracy only in two countries that defy U.S. will, Iran and Syria. Yes, they are pushing for democracy there, and grudgingly. In Syria, they are rather timid now because they are afraid of the alternative. They've seen what happened in Palestine with free elections. They're having second thoughts. Do you see America pushing for democracy in Morocco, Jordan, Egypt, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Algeria, Libya? No, they're not. So it's not true that Arabs are offended by the push for democracy. No, they are offended by America's support for the tyrannies in the Middle East region. I'm sorry? Let alone that, yes. Yes, you had your hand, and then I'll come back to you. Yes. I was just there 2 weeks ago in Qatar for the third time to tape an interview with them. I have been critical of Al Jazeera on Al Jazeera. But I watch Al Jazeera regularly. But I tell you, people say Al Jazeera is like CNN English. I say, no, it's much better than that. Al Jazeera or CNN should be. It's not sensational. It's really professional. It's really good. And it does something that you never told you are. I mean, every time I am asked about Al Jazeera on shows, and people tell, like, Al Jazeera is this. And people who write about Al Jazeera don't know Arabic. Their opinions are as valid as my opinion about Chinese media. I don't know anything about that. But Thomas Friedman doesn't like Al Jazeera. Thomas Friedman doesn't understand Arabic. You know? They hear that it is. There's a new book that came out on Al Jazeera by Mark Lynch, published by Columbia University Press, and he makes that point. It puts two points of views. They do. Having said that, I am critical of what they do because they are beholden to the Qatari government. As a result, there are confines, and since September 11, it got deteriorated. Now they go out of their way to please the United States government. For example, they stopped referring to U.S. troops as U.S. occupation troops in Iraq. If they are not occupation troops, for the love of humanity, tell me, what are they? What are they? Heavily armed tourists? I mean, what are they doing in Iraq? They are occupation troops. They should be called accordingly. And people say, what about the Bin Laden tapes? Well, I have a statistics for you from their bureau chief in Washington, D.C. Since September 11, Al Jazeera aired 12 hours of Bin Laden tapes. And more than 500 hours of Bush tapes. So they do cover. But you see, America, that's not balance. Balance is Fox News. Only one point of view. Yes, please.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, on the first point, I believe that this exclusive attention in general, analytics, this exclusive analytic attention to the Israeli lobby absolves the U.S. administration, whatever it is, of responsibility, the primary legal constitutional responsibility of whatever ills are occurring in American policies and wars in the Middle East. And I think there is that in that paper. You said that in the book they do not tend to generalize about American Jews. I say sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. They have in one passage in that paper in which they talk about Jews who are infiltrated U.S. staff in Congress. For me, that was a very disturbing passage. I didn't like it at all. And I believe that, I mean, when I was teaching in Washington, D.C., I had students from Capitol Hill. And, you know, I felt that most of them are supporters of Israel, no matter what their face is going to be. You said that the Israeli lobby, I mean, is the Israeli lobby strong? Yes, it is very strong. It's very powerful. But I think primarily the complaint we need to register at the U.S. administration, they are the ones who are fulfilling, enacting, and implementing policies and wars in the region, and they are the ones responsible for America's role. I mean, they can easily ignore the lobby. I mean, so in other words, they decide to be in sync with the lobby. So, I mean, it's not that there is some manipulation by the lobby and people are dragged against their will, Clinton and Bush, and they were kicking and screaming against a powerful lobby. I mean, the lobby is very strong, and they have engaged in acts that are, not fully legal, as we have learned recently, and certainly they don't want debate. I mean, there's so much to criticize about them, of course. They don't want debate. They absolutely want to prevent debate. It's an anti-democratic vehicle. It's a vehicle that wants basically to ignore all the victims of Israel, what it does. They have never met a war by Israel that did not bless or, but that's the same for so many sectors in America who have never met a war by Israel that did not endorse and bless. That's true of Jane Fonda. That's true of so many elements in American popular culture and political culture. You said, but on the one hand, they also intimidate people on the left among Jews who... But the lobby is guilty of that, of course, but other non-lobby elements are guilty of that too. People in Congress do that. Tom DeLay did that. The media do that. They just don't want an alternative message. It was the President of the United States who said Sharon, who is treated in Europe as a war criminal, is somebody who cannot travel to many European countries for fear of being dragged into war crime charges, and he was declared to be a man of peace. Bush did that. It's not the lobby told Bush to say it. Same for Clinton. Yes, please. But you see, that's again, an evidence that why it's not the lobby, entirely the lobby. I mean, Ted Kennedy is at the end of his career. He wins the election with more than 75%. He has nothing to worry about. He is not early in his career. And yet, I mean, look at the voting in the Senate. Every time they vote on the Middle East in the Senate, I look at the vote. It's usually 1 to 98, 1 to 99. And the one dissenting vote usually is like Robert Byrd, the oldest living senators ever in U.S. history, who wins elections with 85% of the vote. If you decide not to worry about the lobby, you don't have to. There are many members of Congress who come from districts where they have no Jewish voters. The lobby does work because they are invited to work. I mean, I used to have students who used to work on the Hill on the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senators and congresspeople and staffers, they invite AIPAC. What's your opinion about Iran? They invite them. They ask them. So we have to be careful about that. We have to be critical of the lobby and what it does. We have to be attuned to and know about it. But it seems to me, and I recommend the book by Edward Tivian called The Lobby. It's about the Israeli lobby. And yet, we have to be aware of what America is doing around the world. Somebody like Ted Kennedy, he's an example. I am sure Ted Kennedy, at the end of his life, he's also going to be pro-Israeli. Is that going to be the lobby too? No, he's pro-Israeli. Look at American popular culture. By 3-1, they support Israel over the Palestinians. Are an American people in Iowa or in Oklahoma also victims of the lobby? No. American popular culture, political culture, is also pro-Israeli. Harry Truman. I mean, there was no lobby at the time. Look about how the recognition of Israel came about. You know? There are so many things. I mean, do you know now, after September 11, I am told that 2 million Americans flocked to the Guardian newspaper in England, which has guardian.co.uk. I read every day personally, even though I read the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, you know, and you see a difference. I know, like, people on the left are not supposed to do that, but I'll say it anyway. I think the best magazine there is The Economist. It's written intelligently and with irony, with a great style, and it covers so much about the world. I mean, I don't read the editorials. I never do. But, you know, I read the magazine avidly. So you can read so much now in English. I mean, where do I begin on that subject? But I agree that, and if you know foreign languages, French or other languages, you can also read a lot. And, of course, I have to warn you about members of Congress and the media now are all slaves to an Israeli outfit in Washington called Memory, which basically does very selective translation from the Arabic and Persian press and delivers them. And according to that outfit, basically, Arabs and Muslims are split into two groups. There's one group that supports bin Laden and loves him, another group that loves and supports Bush. And I'm here to tell you that most of the region is neither. They don't like Bush, and they don't like bin Laden either. But that's missing from Memory. If you're interested about Memory, there's a great expose by Brian Whitaker of The Guardian in August of 2002, I believe. I was going to say more, but she had a question. Let's have that last one. Oh, she, okay. One more time. Are you talking about the Middle East or here?
Here.
What's the one more time? I didn't understand it, to be honest with you. Yes. Right. What's the opposite? No. You have to be careful. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, but one has to be careful. Do not be deceived. Anti-Semitism and pro-Zionism, anti-Zionism, anti-Semitism, very different things. Let me confuse you further. You can be anti-Semitic and pro-Zionist. Lord Balfour, who gave the birth certificate of the State of Israel, there are new biographies of him. In 1905, in the House of Commons, he gave a speech which was blatantly anti-Jewish. And many of them felt that they can support the State of Israel because they wanted immigration to Palestine over there, as opposed to here. Many American support for Israel early on was anti-Semitically based. Harry Truman was anti-Semite. I mean, we now know there are so many private papers which authenticate that. Having said that, you can be also anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist, like David Duke and neo-Nazis. They don't like Jews and they don't like Israel. But you can be anti-Zionist without being anti-Semitic. So we have to be we have to distinguish these things. Like, these groups you're talking about, you seem to be confused by it. You shouldn't. They are anti-Semitic and pro-Zionist. I mean, many of them, based on a biblical vision, they want to support Israel because they're preparing for the day of Armageddon when 2/3 of Jews will convert and 1/3 will be exterminated. Certainly not a pleasant image for the Jewish people. It seems to me we in the pro-Palestinian community, we have to be vigilant, which is to insist on our fierce support for Palestinian fundamental rights while
rejecting any anti-Semitic voices in our camp, and also to criticize them whenever they occur, if they occur. It seems to me the Palestinian question is too noble, too just a cause to allow hateful people like anti-Semites to infiltrate into our camp. This is why we should not accept support from the likes of Pat Buchanan or David Duke for Palestinian rights.